Let's begin this message this morning by turning to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians 4, and I want to read verses 11 through 14. It says, "And he gave some as apostles, and some as prophets, and some as evangelists, and some as pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of the service, to the building up of the body of Christ, until we all attain to the unity of faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a mature man, to the measure of the stature which belongs to the fullness of the Christ." And then verse 14 specifically, "As a result, we are no longer to be children, tossed here and there by waves, and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by craftiness and deceitful scheming." Paul makes it clear that we're to have that as our goal, what's described in verses 11 through 13, to become this mature man so that what is described in verse 14 won't happen to us any longer. Hebrews 5:14 speaks of, quote, "the mature, who because of practice have their senses trained to discern good and evil," end quote. Again, people who aren't being swayed by every wind of doctrine that comes along, by every little thing that happens to come down the pike. The title of this message is Mistaken Notions About Our Forefathers, Part 3. In the previous two messages, I believe I have demonstrated, even in just those two, that few indeed in this day and age fit the descriptions found in these two passages, in Ephesians 4 and Hebrews 5. Mature men and women who don't fall for everything that comes down the pike, who don't believe everything that they read and hear in print or over the media airwaves. Already in just two messages, I believe it's been proven that beliefs about our founding fathers are not as the manipulated masses have been led to believe. Now let's continue now to examine further misconceptions portrayed about our forefathers as found in this series of letters to the editors that we're dealing with in this series of messages. In our last message, I read selected portions of two letters written in response to a previous letter to the editor, which was written by Robert L. Mueller of Kimball. In beginning today's message, I would like to examine more closely those two response letters that I just dealt with in limited detail in the last message. The first one I want to read is from August 23, 1992, entitled "Founding Fathers Were Indeed Christians" by, at least as printed, Reverend, or as I prefer, Pastor Dale H. Brown, Mitchell Federated Church. I'm going to read this whole letter to you this time. Here's what it says. This letter is in response to the letter to the editor on August 14th. The letter writer goes into some detail to dispute the concept that America was founded upon the Christian religion. Those who dispute our Christian heritage often quote isolated documents to quote-unquote prove their point, ignoring the vast library of material that shows conclusively that our heritage is distinctly Christian. Consider that 52 of 55 founding fathers who worked on the Constitution were Orthodox evangelical Christians. Patrick Henry declared, quote, within this quote, "It cannot be emphasized too strongly or too often that this great nation was founded not by religionists but by Christians, not on religion but on the gospel of Jesus Christ," end of quote, within a quote. John Quincy Adams stated, quote, within a quote, the indissoluble bond, the highest glory of the American Revolution was this. It connected in one indissoluble bond the principles of civil government with the principles of Christianity," end of quote, within a quote. John Jay, our first Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court and one of the three men responsible for the writing of the Constitution, said, quote, within a quote, "Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it is the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers," end of quote, within a quote. George Washington, a devout Christian, not a deist, in his farewell address declared, quote, within a quote, "Of all the habits and dispositions which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars," end of quote, within a quote. Research shows that in all of the documents recording the words of our founding fathers, the Bible was quoted far more than any other source. In fact, 94% of the quotes of the founding fathers were based in the Bible. The idea for the three branches of government came from Isaiah 33:22 and tax exemption for churches from Ezra 7:24. What about the issue of separation of church and state? These words do not even appear in the Constitution. They were written by Thomas Jefferson in a letter in which he also stated that the wall of separation is a one-directional wall, keeping the government from running the church, but ensuring that Christian principles will always stay in government. In 1854, the House Judiciary Committee wrote, "In this age, there is no substitute for Christianity." That was the religion of the founders of the Republic, and they expected it to remain the religion of their descendants. End of quote, within a quote. James Madison, the chief architect of the Constitution, stated, quote, within a quote, "We have staked the future of all our political institutions upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God," end of quote, within a quote. In 1892, the Supreme Court wrote, quote, within a quote, "Our laws and our institutions must necessarily be based upon and embody the teachings of the Redeemer of mankind. Our civilization and our institutions are emphatically Christian," end of quote, within a quote. One cannot honestly look at America's history in detail and help but be overwhelmed with the concept that whatever it may be today, it was firmly founded upon the Christian religion. Every legislator, teacher, attorney, judge, civic leader, indeed all American citizens, need to see the video America's Godly Heritage by David Barton. Should the letter writer or any caring citizen wish to review it, I would be delighted to point them to a copy, end of quote. Pastor Dale H. Brown, Mitchell Federated Church. Now, I can honestly say, and it's not the case with too many of these letters to the editor, matter of fact, this may be the only one, but I can honestly say that with this particular letter, outside of his use of the term reverend before his name, I didn't find one item or one thing that I disagreed with in this pastor's letter to the editor, and I commend him for that, and I especially commend him for not running with the standard line of tolerance for all religions, which is almost in every other letter to the editor in this series of letters. I commend him for that, and I hope that it's not there because he's taking the biblical stand on that very issue. I hope it just wasn't an oversight on his part. But even though I agree with everything in this particular letter, before leaving this letter, I do want to center in on one particular statement which he made. In paragraph 3, sentence 1, he again wrote this. He said, "John Jay, our first Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court and one of the three men responsible for the writing of the Constitution, said, quote, 'Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it is the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers,'" end quote. Now, not only was that suggested by John Jay, but it was the actual practice found in many states, in the many early states of the United States of America. David J. Brewer, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, in a speech to Harvard College in 1905, stated this. He stated, "In several colonies and states, a profession of the Christian faith was made an indispensable condition to holding office. In the frame of government for Pennsylvania, prepared by William Penn in 1683, it was provided that, quote, all treasurers, judges, and other officers, and all members elected to serve in provincial council and general assembly, and all that have right to elect such members shall be such as profess faith in Jesus Christ," end quote. And in the Charter of Privileges, again quoting from Justice Brewer, "and in the Charter of Privileges for that colony given in 1701 by William Penn and approved by the Colonial Assembly, it was provided that all, quote, that all persons who also profess to believe in Jesus Christ, the Savior of the world, shall be capable to serve this government in any capacity, both legislatively and executively," end of quote. Now, similar requirements can also be found in the Delaware Constitution of 1776, the New Hampshire Constitution of 1704 and 1792, the Fundamental Constitution of the Carolinas, the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut for its governor, the Vermont Constitution of 1777, the Maryland Constitution of 1776, the current Maryland Bill of Rights, Article 37, the Mississippi Constitution of 1817 and the Arkansas Constitution of 1874 with 1963 supplements, most of which are also listed in Justice Brewer's speech. And the point being is that John Jay recognized that as a Christian nation, we need to elect Christian rulers to rule over that nation. And indeed it was the fact in many states, and in a couple still is the case, until this message gets out and the ACLU finds out about it. And they'll be fast to put an end to that if they certainly can. The point is, it should, John Jay understood it needed to be that way, and it should be that way. Now people would be shocked if someone was to suggest the very same thing for today. The majority of people today would be absolutely shocked to their toes if someone would suggest that the only people who should be in public office today are Christians. And yet, that is exactly what we are told to do in the Scriptures. And not only would people generally be shocked, but the majority of Christians today would be shocked. And yet it's found in Scriptures. We're told to do that very thing in Scriptures. Turn with me to Exodus chapter 18 to begin with. Exodus 18 and just verse 21. Listen to what we're told to do. It says, "Furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able men." Of course we want able men. It doesn't end there. "Able men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain. And you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens." Boy, how many do we have in office today that fit that description? Turn also to Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy 17, and verses, follow with me through verses 14 through 20. It says, "When you enter the land which Yahweh your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, 'I will set a king over me like the nations who are around me.'" I think King James just simply says ruler. "You shall surely set a king over you whom Yahweh your God chooses, one from among your own countrymen. You shall not set as king over yourselves." Excuse me. "You shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner or stranger over yourselves who is not your countryman." That word countryman really means of your same race or lineage. It's talking about a stranger, a non-Israelite in this case, and in the case today as well. Of course, so we could eliminate a good majority of those who are ruling today in America simply by this one aspect of this directive to begin with. There shouldn't be strangers ruling over our people. This, and keep in mind that this country, America, was not only established as a Christian nation, it was established as a white nation. And we shouldn't be fearful of saying that, and we shouldn't shrink back from saying that because somebody wants to call it racism. That's just fact. This nation was established as a white Christian nation. Clear. It's even in the Bill of Rights that that's what our founding fathers intended it to be. And according to God's law, if this was indeed a Christian white nation, there should be no strangers of non-white lineage ruling over us. Plain and simple. There it is. Going on, though, there's much more that is found in this directive. Verse 16. "Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Since Yahweh has said to you, 'You shall never again return that way.' Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself." Then verses 18 through 20, it says, "Now it shall come about, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear Yahweh his God, by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, in order that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom and in the midst of Israel." Now again, how many today fit that description? And people, let me tell you, November 2nd is coming up just a few days away, or November 3rd, just a couple days away from today. And the people are going to go to the polls, Christians are going to go to the polls, and I know some of you are going to go to the polls. But I want to tell you, that's the kind of person you need to be looking to elect. And if you can't find that type of person, you've got no purpose or reason trying to vote for them. Don't vote. Register your vote, your non-vote, as a vote. And I'll tell you what, our country, our nation, the reports are coming down, they're getting concerned about the number of people who aren't voting because they're getting out of the corral. They're realizing that our people are starting to wake up. And as I pointed out in the First Commandment series, we break the First Commandment. If we vote into office or even attempt to vote into office, somebody who doesn't fit this bill. And I want to tell you, there isn't one man on that ticket that fits the bill. And I know I'm stepping on toes, but I need to step on toes. It's First Commandment disobedience. Unless you can prove that what I stated in there is being wrong, we're unequally yoking ourselves. Whether he's the best of the worst, he's still the worst. He's still not God's choice. God has made it clear what his choice is. Right there. And there isn't one of them, you know it as well as I do, that's going to do what's described in these last three verses of this chapter. Who's going to write out the law of God and read it daily and read it and practice it and perform it and put it into practice for our people. It's just not going to happen. The point, though, that's a little bit off base. The point is that it's not off base. God intends his people. He expects his preachers first to preach it and say, hey, we're to be electing Christian men to office. Not men who put on a front of Christianity when it just so happens to fit the case of their political run. And the people need to expect the same from their religious leaders, that they be preaching the same. My question is this morning, why aren't America's preachers today suggesting, even demanding, the same thing that we find very clearly there in scriptures? Why? Well, I'll tell you why. Because most of today's preachers, with their 501c3 status, serve the state and its requirements rather than God and his laws. Good case in point. I shared this in a previous message to you once before, and I'm not just running down Dr. James Dobson, head of Focus on the Family. But the fact is, it's printed right here for anyone to read it in the back of the January 1989 Focus on the Family magazine. You'll remember it as I read it to you. It says, it's on the feedback, on the very back page. It said, voters' concern. These are letters to the editor, what they basically come down to. And it says, although the election 88 article, October, was good and certainly expressed some sound and helpful information, there was no mention of any candidate endorsement. My surprise lies in the fact that Focus on the Family normally takes a strong and moral stand on the ideals of Christianity and the value of the family. Now, before I read the editor's reply, let me ask you, do you think that God intended the people, or the heads of the people religiously, according to what we read in Deuteronomy 17, to say, hey, this is a God, ungodly man. Here is the man who follows God's law. You think God had any problem with that? I think he expected the religious leaders of whatever organization to stand up and say, you can't vote for that man. He's ungodly. He's unrighteous. He'll take us to the pits of hell. And to point them to a man, if indeed there was any man, and as often was the case, there was no man to stand in the gap. But when there wasn't, he didn't tell him to go vote for the best of the worst. So, shouldn't that be Dr. Dobson's response here? Absolutely not. He says, as a nonprofit 501c3 organization, Focus on the Family does not. Let's be honest, Dr. James Dobson. Focus on the Family cannot. It does not. You serve your God when it comes to this area. You cannot, because your God told you you cannot, make political endorsements. You think he's repented since I preached on that last time? Well, I doubt he heard the message. But he hasn't. Still hasn't repented of his idolatry, because this is the Focus on the Family letter from October 1992. Just received it. And here's what he says in it. You may be thinking, but who are the good guys who have stood up for the family in Washington? And who are the legislators who have opposed and undermined it? Yeah, we would like to know that. We need some preachers that will stand up and point them out and say, these are the good guys. And yet, what does he say? I am not permitted by the tax code to answer that question as a representative of Focus on the Family. Even apart from the law, it would be improper for me to politicize the organization. You know how sad when that's the case with so many of our people today who serve the state in their 501c3 status and their laws rather than God and His laws. Then we have some who are a little bit braver. I received this mailing just recently. It came from Randall Terry's organization, or I think from Randall Terry himself. Here's what it says in the beginning of it, or the front of it. It says, Christians, beware. To vote for Bill Clinton is to sin against God. See why inside. We'll look inside. Well, that's an interesting statement. He's a little bit bold there. Matter of fact, I believe, if I remember correctly, in the letter that came with this, he said he came down on those who would let their 501c3 status keep them from speaking out. And so he says, to vote for Bill Clinton is sin against God. And then he has this to say inside. At one point he says, do you think God will bless America with a man of Clinton's character as president? If Bill Clinton is elected, he will help destroy 3 centuries of Christianity in America. Now see, my question is, why didn't Randall Terry say, to vote for Bill Clinton, George Bush, or Ross Perot is sin? Do you think that the same couldn't be said about the other two men? Again, do you think God will bless America with a man of Clinton's character as president? If Bill Clinton is elected, he will help destroy 3 centuries of Christianity in America. Don't you think that is exactly what Bush has been doing? The whole point of this is to put down Clinton and elevate Bush. Bush has been doing that very thing. Maybe not as openly, but I'd rather a man be open about his sin than what George Bush is. He goes on, the challenge, brethren, if you're considering to vote for Bill Clinton, wake up, come to your senses, repent. The only ethical choice for us come November 3rd is to vote in accord with righteousness. Is Bush in accord with righteousness? Is Perot in accord with righteousness? I'll answer that one, no way. Look at what he stands for. Look what he's planning to do with this nation if he gets elected. And then he quotes some men on the back. Reverend Keith, I think it's Tucci, Director of Operation Rescue National. He said that the most wicked men in history have hidden behind superficial Christianity. Bill Clinton fits the mold. You going to tell me that the other two don't? Only superficial Christians would vote for him. Well, maybe that's the same for the other two. We are calling all pastors with spiritual integrity to tell their congregations that Bill Clinton is a mocker of God and therefore undeserving of any person's vote. Why aren't they saying it about the other two as well? Here is Reverend Rod, quote-unquote reverends on these, as you well know. Quote-unquote Reverend Rod Aguillard, senior pastor of Reserve Church in Louisiana. He said, as a minister of God and of the gospel, I cannot support Bill Clinton for any public office because he is pro-abortion and pro-homosexual. With Clinton as president, it's just a matter of time before we are persecuted for our Christianity. You mean we aren't being persecuted today for our Christianity? Come on, talk about wake up. This is what I'm teaching my people. Then we've got some that even get a little bit bolder than that. This one I received last week in the mail. And they are getting a little bolder. I've got to give them. This is from the National Right to Life PAC, Political Action Committee. About the same as 501c3 status. Here's what it says. Who can be trusted with life? And then they've got Bill Clinton and George Bush and Ross Perot listed down. Poor Ross, he didn't even merit a picture. But then here's the point. Here's what it says. The children deserve a president they can trust. And so do you. For the children's sake and for everyone's sake, vote George Bush for president Thursday, November 3rd, 1992. Now this one's even bolder, and it surprised me, even bolder than Randall Terry. He never said who to vote for. He said who not to vote for. But the Right to Life people even got bolder than that, and they said who to vote for in spite of their fact that they're political action committee. And I got to give them a hand for that. They've got a little bit bolder than they would have maybe years in the past. But indeed, the children deserve a president they can trust. And so do you, for your children's sake and for everyone's sake, vote George Bush for president? You've got to be kidding. These are people who believe and would proclaim Christianity. You know, let's vote. Unless there's not anyone standing in the gap, let's vote what the Bible says to vote. And if you can't find one, register a non-vote to show this country that there are people who are rising up, that the people are amassing and going to rise up someday and not allow this to go on. That someday we will have someone who will stand in the gap as it should be done. What would happen if someone was to recommend today the same thing which John Jay did? Where he said, quote, it is the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers, end quote. Or to suggest, as James Madison did, that, quote, we have staked the future of all of our political institutions upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God, end quote. You know, what would happen if someone was to recommend what John Jay did? If someone was to suggest what James Madison did? Why, the preachers would say, the law has been done away! The press wouldn't even print the statement. And the ADL would scream to high hell that it's bigotry, racism, and hatred. And the ACLU would prosecute such a man for violation of separation of church and state. Why? Well, because as I pointed out before, we are a conquered nation. A conquered Christian nation, that is. Somewhere along the way, our people stopped following the biblical mandates for electing government leaders, stopped taking the advice of men like John Jay and James Madison, and began electing non-Christians, even anti-Christian men, to rule in this country. In other words, Christianity began to turn over the dominion they once possessed to the enemies of Christ. It's exactly what's happened. And that which was on top, that is, a Christian civil body politic, which was on top, was turned upside down and is now on the bottom, so that we only have the lesser of three evils to choose from. Obviously, if we are ever to return to what God expects from us, we must turn things right side up once again, which will return us to a Christian nation ruled by Christian men. Let's go to the next letter that I just read briefly out of in the last message. This one's entitled Founding Fathers Encourage Christianity, not sure of the date, by J.E. Purvis in Scott's Bluff. He wrote, as a casual student of early American history, I was puzzled by the August 14th letter to the editor claiming that our nation's founding fathers were deists and that our nation has no theological foundation. The original documents show otherwise. The founding fathers would often credit the hand of Providence, God, for the rise of our nation. Many were members of the Anglican Episcopal Church, including Patrick Henry, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and nearly half the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Those who acknowledged God's guidance could hardly be called deist. According to the deist, God created the universe, then quietly sat back to watch, resolute in his policy of non-interference. He's a very impersonal God. Yes, Thomas Jefferson was a deist. He was even presumptuous enough to write his own version of the New Testament, carefully deleting all references to the divinity of Christ. He was also responsible for the concept of separation of church and state, which is not found in the Constitution. George Washington was another lifelong Anglican. He composed his own prayers and wrote them in a journal that he carried as a sort of prayer book. In it, he wrote of a very personal God. Yes, we already accept the proposition that people are free to practice any religion whatsoever or none at all. We have no state-sponsored religion. However, the paper trail clearly reveals that the founding fathers encouraged practice of the Christian faith because the greatness of the nation is in the goodness of its people. Sadly, revisionist history is far too common today. Its purveyors include those who hold Columbus responsible for generations of perceived genocide and those who blame the totality of the world's problems on European white males. These viewpoints are, however, politically correct. PC. The point is, watch for hidden agendas. For some, truth is less important than advancing their own prejudices. Revisionist history is often just another term for poor scholarship. J.E. Not only did Mr. Purvis understand that there are people and organizations with hidden agendas, with aims to destroy Christian America, who are rewriting history to in the promotion of their agendas, but he also understood that their agenda is the destruction of white Christian America. Most of what he had to write I agreed with, and again want to center in on probably just one statement, if I remember correctly, just one statement of this, or one point of this particular letter to the editor. Here's what he said in paragraph 4. Again, listen carefully. He said, "Sadly, revisionist history is far too common today. Its purveyors," and of course he's referring back to the fact that they have rewritten our Christian history, but then he goes on to say, he says, "Its purveyors include those who hold Columbus responsible for generations of perceived genocide and those who blame the totality of the world's problems on European white males. These viewpoints are, however, politically correct." Now, to verify the accuracy of Mr. Purvis's statement, let me read from historian Wilmot Robertson's book, The Dispossessed Majority. If you don't have a copy of this, I would highly suggest that you get one. It's an amazing book. It verifies many things, very well documented from a historical standpoint of what's happened here in America over the last several decades. On pages 2, I'll read from pages 283 and 284. Here's what he says. He says, "There are just as many white as black organizations on the lookout for, quote, racial slights, end quote, in courses and textbooks which do not elaborate fully on minority contributions to American history or persecutions of minorities abroad." In other words, not only are the blacks involved in this, but the whites have been so brainwashed that they are joining up with the blacks and Hispanics and so forth and doing the same thing, looking out for these slurs that white men make. Then footnote number 37, he says, "In October 1960, the New York City Board of Education sent a letter to 100 textbook publishers asking for, quote, substantial revisions," end quote. Okay, historical revisionists is what we're talking about. "In history books to place a much sharper emphasis on German atrocities against minorities in World War II." That was from Overview, October 1961, and page 53. Continuing on now out of the footnote, he says, "At their insistence, which often borders on outright coercion, many such textbooks have been rewritten and more have been replaced." Footnote number 38, he says, "In California, minority lobbies forced a resolution through the Oakland Board of Education to purchase textbooks which, quote, accurately portray the contribution of minority groups in America," end quote, San Francisco Chronicle, January 23, 1963, page 30. Continuing, he says, "Concurrently, public educational facilities have been put at the disposal of minority groups for research projects highly critical of majority institutions." Footnote number 39, "The B'nai B'rith Anti-Defamation League gave $500,000 to the University of California, a state university, to investigate the role Christian churches play in fostering anti-Semitism. Look Magazine, June 4th, 1963, page 78. Continuing, although minorities generally supported by British or, excuse me, although minorities generally supported the British or were neutral in the War of Independence, a reading of recently published school and college text would indicate that without minority assistance, Americans might now be swearing allegiance to Queen Elizabeth II. Crispus Attucks," and I'm not sure of what nationality, he says, "has become," "Crispus Attucks has become an important figure in American history, so important that an illustrated child's history of colonial times published in 1969 gives him more space than George Washington." Hyman Solomon, a Polish-born commission merchant, who is a Jew, by the way, "is another recently discovered minority hero," he's got hero in quotes, "of American independence and has been awarded an article under his own name in the Encyclopedia Britannica although he was more than once welcomed behind the British lines. It's pretty well known that Chaim Soliman was a traitor to American independence. On the other hand, those Negroes in the War of Independence who supplied British warships off the southern coast and who remained on board as volunteers are seldom featured in the quote-unquote new history. Further proof that indeed Mr. Purvis understood what he was talking about. Also confirmed in a Newsweek, December 24th, 1990 article called Thought Police. And if you remember, a couple years ago, did two messages just on this article. But let me read again from this to further confirm that the revisionist history has plans not only to destroy Christianity, but to destroy white Christianity or anything white in this land. Reading again from the Newsweek article entitled Thought Police, paragraph 2 on page 48, it says, there is an experiment of sorts taking place in American colleges, more accurately, hundreds of experiments at different campuses directed at changing the consciousness of the entire generation of university students. So let me stop there. Those experiments have been going on for years and years and years. This isn't something new. They're just finally admitting it. Going on, the goal is to eliminate prejudice, not just the petty sort that shows up on sophomore dorm walls, but the grand prejudice that has ruled American universities since their founding. What could it be? That the intellectual tradition of Western Europe occupies the central place in the history of civilization. Well, it does. How can that be prejudice? In its context, it would not be enough for a student to refrain from insulting homosexuals or minorities. He or she would be expected to affirm their presence on campus and to study their literature and culture alongside that of Plato, Shakespeare, and Locke. This agenda is broadly shared by most organizations of minority students, feminist and gays. It is also the program of a generation of campus radicals who grew up in the 60s and are now achieving positions of academic influence. If they no longer talk of taking to the streets, it is because they now are gaining access to the conventional weapons of campus politics, social pressure, academic perks, including tenure, and when they have the administration on their side, outright coercion, the rewriting of history. Jumping to page 51. Let me read as well from this article, paragraph number 12. It says, one of the most controversial PC, or politically correct, initiatives took place at the University of Texas at Austin, where the English faculty recently chose a new text for the freshman composition course, which is required for about half the entering undergraduates. Up till now, instructors had been free to assign essays on a range of topics for students to read and discuss. Henceforth, all readings will be from an anthology called Racism and Sexism, an Integrated Study by Paula S. Rothenberg. The selections, some of which are excellent, comprise a primer of PC thought. In the first chapter, Rothenberg answers what many white men wonder but few dare ask. Why are they the only ones ever accused of racism or sexism? The sine qua non of racism and sexism, Rothenberg explains, is subordination, which in Western society is exercised only by whites over blacks and men over women. Hence, reverse racism and sexism, by definition, do not exist. Again, total control of what they're to believe, think, and teach. Going on one more spot. On page 54, in paragraph 21, it reads, the rejection of hierarchy underlies another key PC tenet, multiculturalism. This is an attack on the primacy of the Western intellectual tradition as handed down through centuries of great books. In the PC view, this canon perpetuates the power of dead white males over women and blacks from beyond the grave. It obliges black students to revere the thoughts of Thomas Jefferson, who was a literal slave owner. In opposition to this Eurocentric view of the world, Molefi Asante, chairperson of African American Studies at Temple, has proposed an Afrocentric curriculum. It would be based on the thoughts of ancient African scholars, and the little-known cultures of modern East and West Africa. This would be one of many such ethnic-specific curricula he foresees in a multicultural America. Quote, there are only two positions, end quote, Asante says sweepingly. Quote, either you support multiculturalism in American education or you support the maintenance of white supremacy, end quote. You either support multiculturalism, whether you're in the Kingdom Israel Identity Movement, or whether you're a neo-Nazi, or whether you're any of these other things, you either support multiculturalism or you're a white supremacist, plain and simple. All of that certainly proves that indeed there are some who have hidden agendas to rewrite our history and to destroy, literally destroy, white Christian America. And by the way, they have done a pretty good job of it already. Let me prove to you. Prove to you that their experiments, quote unquote experiments, have had their effect. I'm not going to have time in this series to read these two letters to the editor in their entirety, but let me read some of them to prove the point that their goals and agendas, quote unquote experiments, have indeed had their effect by or evidenced by what's found in these two letters. Beginning with spiritual values, one entitled Spiritual Values Are the True Family, Spiritual Values Are the True Family Values. And you read just the title, it sounds pretty good. But let me read paragraphs 4 through 6 of this letter. This was written by Carlisle J. Smith of Gering on September 16th. Paragraph 4, he begins, in an effort to guard against Christianity being a state religion, which it is not, some people take a position that denies that our country was founded on Judeo-Christian teachings. Well, he's made a big mistake right there, because it wasn't founded on Judeo-Christian teachings, it was founded only on Christian teachings. Continuing, he says, I can understand the changing nature of our population because of an increased mixture of various ethnic and cultural and religious traditions. But in essence, we all worship the same God, even though we may address Him by different titles. If our nation is to solve the multitude of problems facing us, we need to recognize the benefits of God's truths with a strong emphasis on tolerance and less talk about differences. The phrase, family values, is an empty, meaningless phrase until it includes an effort on the part of the families to become actively involved in some spiritual development of the faith, of a faith made available through some church, synagogue, or mosque. Paragraph 6, in calculating God's truth, which gives society a solid rock on which to build. Now, where have I heard solid rock before? Solid rock is a foundation. You certainly don't hear about it in a synagogue or a mosque. You're only going to find about it in one place, and that's in the Scriptures, that Christ and obedience to His Word is the solid rock upon which we stand. He says, in calculating God's truth, which gives society a solid rock on which to build character and solve problems, is sadly missing from our public assemblies and classrooms when we fail to give credit to the God who established constructive values by the omission of prayer from commencement ceremonies and the beginning of daily classroom activities in our public schools. And you see how this thing is interwoven. There's some good and some bad interwoven here together. But you interweave the two, and you're going to end up with something that could be called maybe lukewarm. And what did God say about lukewarm? He said, I'll vomit it out of my mouth. I'd rather you be hot or cold. But he says, we need to have prayer in our commencement ceremonies and before school each morning. But then he says, we surely are mature enough people to offer the kinds of prayer that can be acceptable to more than one religious faith if we carefully phrase such prayers to answer the needs of Christian, Jew, and Muslim. Won't comment any more of that, but let me go to the next one that was also written the next day, or printed the next day, September 17th, 1992, by Claire Brown of Mitchell, entitled All Spiritual Paths Deserve Respect. Doesn't that sound nice? This letter is in response to a September 11th letter to the editor. Every person holds cherished beliefs that give form and meaning to their everyday lives. I hear your own strong belief in Jesus Christ is the only way to give meaning in your life. By the way, this is in response to the other letter that was printed the same day mine was. However, through reading and studying in my own deep beliefs, I find and respect the many spiritual paths to be found in my world. The path of Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Islam, Judaism, Baha'i, Native American, spirituality, and Christianity. A statement of faith for me is to recognize that I am a part of an interdependent web of life. I pray that all people will know how much more alike we are in our aspirations to give life meaning than we are different. The Native Americans have a belief that says we are related to all things, quote, all my relatives, end quote. Jesus said as much when he proclaimed, quote, whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother, end quote, Mark 3:35. Problem, of course, is the Indians don't do his will, so they can't be relatives. Continuing, I do not purport to change your beliefs. I would hope that where the world is seeing the tragedy of ethnic and religious strife, there will come a day when all people can see this delicate, beautiful blue planet we call Earth as one Earth, and that there is only one race, the human race, and that there is only one God with many names, Great Spirit, Wakantanka, Allah, Yahweh, Rama, Krishna, etc., Claire Brown of Mitchell. Now, there is a lot in those last two letters that could be addressed, but for the sake of time, I'm not going to. But, for the sake of time, let me just deal with the title of that particular letter to the editor. The title was, All Spiritual Paths Deserve Respect. You know, and again, how nice that sounds. It has a nice PC ring to it, doesn't it? It's politically correct for this day and age. But does that mean all spiritual paths deserve respect? Does that mean that Judaism's promotion of incest and bestiality deserves respect? Does that mean that Hinduism's sanction of wife killing deserves respect? Does that mean that Jim Jones' encouragement of mass suicide deserves respect? I mean, come on, people. Wake up. You know, it sounds nice. And it certainly fits in with the way so many people think today. But why don't you think it through just a little bit? And this woman either is dishonest with what she would have to admit as being true if she just think it about a little bit, or she herself is a promoter of incest and bestiality, of wife killing and mass suicide. I don't think she probably is. I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt. But let's get rid of this, all spiritual paths deserve respect. It's just not true. It never has been and never will be. You know, let there be no doubt, Mr. Purvis knew what he was talking about. You know, it's because of revisionist, their rewriting of history that many Americans believe today in the separation of church and state, pluralism, multiculturalism, and the tolerance of all religions. Whereas, none of these ideas were known, promoted, or tolerated by our founding fathers, and even more importantly, by the God of the Christian Bible. None of them. Now, that'll take care of letters that we've touched upon in the past. Let's go to a brand new letter at this time. This one was written on August 27th, 1992, printed on August 27th. It's by Harry F. Kenyon of Mitchell, entitled Churches Shouldn't Take Political Action. The following is shortened from the material prepared by Paul H. Beatty in, quote, A Point of View, end quote, circulated by Unitarian Universalist for Freedom of Conscience, end quote. Churches, quote, this is the quote from that point of view. Quote, churches and their national associations should not take institutional social action, pass resolutions, maintain a lobbyist in Washington, D.C., publish books largely on just one side of the political spectrum, or fund questionable social projects. To take institutional social action commits all members who should never be compelled to support causes that their consciences question. To be a religious liberal is not necessarily to be a political liberal. One should not be overwhelmed by a vote if they have not been convinced. The pulpit can try to convince people on new social possibilities. There are ways that are proper to stimulate social change. Churches can be a stimulus to action and could create local and national organizations which take social action, but only in the names of those who have chosen to join them and to contribute to them. Church funds should not be raided to support the political causes of a few or a bare majority. The most effective vehicles for social change are the myriad of voluntary associations which have focused purposes and organizations like the Civil Liberties Union, or the Urban League. End of quote, Harry F. Kenyon of Mitchell. Now, if ever there was, there's a classic example of what Yahshua described as good-for-nothing Christianity in Matthew 5 and verse 13, where he said, "You are the salt of the earth, but if your salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore, except to be trampled, to be thrown out and trampled under the foot of men." Basically, that proposition was saying Christians, churches should not be involved in political action, in any social action of any kind. Instead, let's give it to those who are designed to be involved in those very areas. But again, what would one expect from the Unitary Universalist for Freedom of Conscience? And one, of course, at least from my point of view, one could hardly consider Unitarianism as Christian. But here is what is tragic, that statement by the Unitarian Church fairly well represents the biggest majority of what today is called Christianity. They believe there should be little, if any, political action, even James Dobson's action. We certainly shouldn't get Focus on the Family involved politically in any sense of the word. It would be ungodly to do so. Even Dobson's organization, and whether he likes it or not, he's politically involved because he does take some stand on some good issues, and he does try to get it across to the people, and he is politically involved. But regretfully, so many today are well represented by that statement I just read from that letter to the editor. You know, what a job has been done on our people. Those called Christians today have been brainwashed into believing that they shouldn't be involved in politics. First, by the redefining of separation of church and state, and second, by making politics a dirty word. And of course, Christians and churches certainly shouldn't be involved in anything dirty, should they? But just what is politics? Well, let me give you some definitions. Here's Webster's 1828 definition of politics. Politics, the science of government, the part of ethics which consists in the regulation and government of a nation or state for the preservation of its safety, peace, and prosperity, comprehending the defense of its existence and rights against foreign control or conquest, the augmentation of its strength and resources, and the protection of its citizens in their rights. Is there anything there that Christians shouldn't be involved in? And then listen to the last of it. With the preservation and improvement of their morals. That's Webster's 1828 definition of politics. Now think about this. Without Christianity's involvement in politics, government is left to creating its own morality, which is nothing short of humanism. The legislation of immorality rather than morality. We've turned it over and given it to the enemies of morality. Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary defines politics, at least its number one definition is, one, the art or science of government. The art or science concerned with guiding or influencing governmental policy. The art or science concerned with winning and holding control over a government. Man, do our people need some lessons in the science and art of holding control, of winning and holding control over government. We've turned it over. When in the past we had that art down, that science understood, and our Christian people today need to get it down once again, and how are they going to do it? They're going to do it by getting involved in politics once again. And I'm not talking about just going out and voting somebody in the office. And that's all they want us to, that's all, that, they don't want Christians involved in politics, period. But if you're going to be involved, just limit it to voting. I'm not talking about voting, and you know full well I'm not. I'm talking about taking control of it and making our body politic a Christian civil body politic. They're two different things. Bouvier's Law Dictionary simply defines politics as everything that concerns the government of the country. We should be involved, people. So the question is not whether Christians should be involved in politics, but whether Christians should be involved in government or not. Now, should Christians be involved in government? Some are going to say yes, Some are going to say no. What am I going to say? I'm going to say, hold that thought until next week. We've run out of time. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we indeed are very thankful to You for Your goodness, for Your direction and leading always in our lives. Father, as the time nears, Father, to when our people are once again going to be electing someone into the position of president, electing many others into different offices, we pray that somehow, Lord, through this process, there would be something that would awaken even more, Father, that this is not the answer for our country. Father, we cannot elect ungodly, unrighteous, non-Christian, and sometimes even anti-Christian men into office and expect Your blessings upon us. I pray, Father, that godly men would rise, that You would raise them up. But, Father, I know that You have to first raise the people, the remnant of Israel, to understand and to see that indeed we are to be about the business, about Your business, the King's business of taking dominion. Lead us and guide us in this. Awaken us. Use these messages to do that very thing. And to bring praise, glory, and honor to Your great and holy name, in and through Yeshua the Christ. Amen. Service of Scott's Bluff.